சகனாபவது சகனௌ புனக்து சகவீரியம் கரவாவகை தேஜஸ்வினாவதீதமஸ்து மாவித்விஷாவகை. ஓம் சாந்தி சாந்தி சாந்தி. ஹரிஹி ஓம். லெட் தேர் பி பீஸ் அண்ட் ஹார்மனி இன் தி ஹார்ட்ஸ் ஆஃப் ஆல். ஓம் பீஸ் பீஸ் பீஸ். So the subject of discussion during this retreat is how to succeed spiritually in the workplace and in home life. As an introduction to this subject, I shall make a few observations. Very often when we talk about spirituality, we think, well, it's something that that's okay in the worship room, when we go to a place of worship, or when we read a scripture, or perhaps when we listen to a hymn or a prayer, that is spiritual. And all other activities, household responsibilities, household work, professional obligations, they're all non-spiritual or secular. So this is a normal tendency to draw a line between the secular and spiritual. Now, the purpose of Vedanta is to make this dividing line disappear, to remove the line of demarcation between the secular and spiritual. To begin with, to construct a bridge between the secular and spiritual. Can we link the secular with the spiritual? Is it possible to link our ordinary work obligations, household responsibilities, professional obligations? Can we link them to spirituality? That's one of the central themes of Vedanta. So when Vivekananda interpreted religion and spirituality in modern language, he coined an expression. So its literal meaning is worshipping the ordinary human beings or serving the ordinary human beings as a worship of God. So this was the expression that he coined. For that he recommended three important paths, again, to link the secular with the spiritual. Now I shall say a few things about what spirituality implies in modern times. Well, if you look upon spirituality as a part of religion, then there is always a problem. Because when you talk about religion, there is always some unpleasantness, something not so very happy about it. It's not because of religion or God, but because of its disturbing associations with totally non-spiritual things that happened or that took place in the name of religion and God. So, some of the greatest spiritual personalities were deeply religious. There's no doubt about it. Some of the greatest spiritual teachers were exponents of great religious ideas. But very often, religion came to be looked upon as a divisive, a disturbing trend, as a disturbing element in human civilization. At the same time, there being many great spiritual personalities who are not religious in the conventional sense of the word religious. So when you talk about religion, You think of a god, you think of a book, some rituals. Buddha perhaps did not belong to this category. Buddha did not look upon a single book as something sacred, as a gift from God. And he did not affirm the existence of a creator God. But he is considered to be one of the greatest spiritual personalities of the world. In short, these are some of the interesting aspects about religion. So spirituality, going beyond religion, implies a kind of interconnectedness. When we become spiritual, we become true to our real self. When we become spiritual, on the one hand, we feel a kind of inner tranquility, peace, happiness, fulfillment at the subjective level. And we are also able to convey this experience in our interaction with others. We become more broad-minded, more tolerant, and we become more understanding of views and ideas which we may not fully agree with, but still we can live with. In fact, this is one of the cornerstones of what it means to be spiritual. Spirituality is a very, very abstract term. We may not be able to define it in a straitjacket, within a few words, but then we can always point out, we can always express in words what it actually implies. So spirituality, in essence, means a feeling of inner fulfillment. When we do something, when we live in a particular way, we feel a total freedom from friction, an inner harmony and peace, a joy and fulfillment, which is very difficult to explain or to define, but is intensely and strongly felt in a very unmistakable way. So that's one aspect of spirituality at the subjective level. You cannot explain it, we cannot define it, but you can never mistake it. You will feel it at the subjective level. Then in our interaction with others, it expresses in the form of broad-mindedness, harmony, understanding, tolerance. Again, the ability to live with ideas and persons who or which may be different from ours. So this is one unmistakable aspect of spirituality. Now in modern times, especially in highly complex societies, where there is so much in demand, you have to be very active, you have to be very efficient, you can't make a failure, there is a lot of challenges and uncertainties, unknown risks, insecurities. These are some of the unavoidable complexities of modern industrial life. You can't afford to make a failure. And in the midst of all this, when we rise up to face these challenges, one of the greatest casualties is the institution of family. Family, from a sociological point of view, is one of the vital, one of the cornerstones of civilized life. Family is the foundation of civilized life. And the kinship, the relationship between different members of the family, is one of the vital factors that have helped humanity to survive. Now, in modern 21st century, it started almost towards the end of the last millennium. One of the most challenging scenarios is the threat that the institution of family is facing. So the modern challenge is how to combine the traditional family values, how to make this value survive, and at the same time succeed in modern life. So that's the subject we are going to discuss. I used one word, success, here, and that is something much to do with workplace, you know, professional obligations. Success is a very important word in modern times. But success is not always successful. If we always succeed, and if the values collapse, then at the end of the journey, who is going to enjoy all the billions of dollars we are investing in the bank if we don't have the psychological health or the physical health to make use of this? Recently, I read, you know, a rich man, in fact, he's in South India, a rich man who was running a sugar mill, and he's he has a monopoly of running sugar mills and rice mills. And he was just about to die. He was more than 90 years. So he said, I have the largest number of rice mills in India, but I can't eat rice. And he is at the monopoly of sugar mills, he can't eat sugar. So that in a way illustrates the tragic state of modern civilization. A thing like, you know, problems of success, problems of efficiency, problems of perfectionism. So there is such a thing as a problems of success. When you succeed, then what next? So suppose you have got billions of dollars in the bank, a wonderful job, a good reputation, and everything going on fine. And then the question arises, what next? And that's a very serious problem. That's a gap that is difficult to fill, unless you are a spiritual person. Now, if you are poor, the solution is simple and straightforward. We can work hard, get a good job, make money, do business. If you are unhealthy, if you are sick, well, we can go to the hospital. So these are problems which can be remedied at empirical level. But suppose you are the most successful person, plenty of money, wonderful job, all things going fine for you. And then what next? So that's why it is said that the two countries in the world which are quite advanced, where everything is looked after by the state, Japan, Sweden, Switzerland, Holland, all these 3-4 countries, they have got the highest suicide rates in the world. Depression, the highest level of depression is found in Japan, where, you know, where pension, education, everything is being looked after by the state. So that means there is something else that is needed for human life. Even to be able to enjoy life, you need something other than what normally we try to achieve for enjoyment. So that's the importance of spiritual life. So what we call a kind of inner harmony, a feeling, a sense of fulfillment, a sense of completeness. Well, I have done something which I should have done. That's what spirituality actually means in our subjective life. And when we achieve this, then we express this inner spiritual growth in our interactions with others. So I shall take up a few verses from one of the texts from the Bhagavad Gita. Well, I can just refer to one interesting dialogue between the student and the teacher in the Gita. It's a very interesting dialogue. It comes in the sixth chapter. So Arjuna is the disciple. He listened to the long discussion, dialogue from his teacher, Krishna, who talked to him about yoga, meditation, prayer, knowledge, spirituality, contemplation, all these wonderful topics. Then Arjuna puts one question. Well, suppose every day I spend a lot of time for meditation, for prayer, and read holy scriptures. Then I get a lot of inner joy and fulfillment. Does it mean that I have achieved everything? But suppose you have a deviation. You know, sometimes when we are transferred to another place where we don't have an opportunity to listen to spiritual ideas, then suddenly there will be we may discontinue our connection with spiritual ideas, spiritual persons or spiritual associations. What happens then? So you have spent a lot of time, lot of energy, lot of efforts you have spent to practice meditation, prayer every day. But then there is a deviation. This happens. It's a big question in our life. It's a big question of St. Augustine's conversion. St. Augustine was leading a very wayward life. His mother was very much concerned. Then there was a transformation. So in his confessions, he gives a long description of how he led a very indisciplined life and later how he had a transformation. This happened to him. But that transformation was real because he had an experience which showed him that unless he broke off from his previous life, he will have no future. That kind of transformation could happen. But even then, if you don't continue in your effort, there could be a deviation. So there is a verse, Ayadi Saddhayo Pedu Yoga Chalidamanasaha Aprapa Yoga Samsiddhim Kamkadim Krishna Gachari. Don't worry about the verse. What it means is, what is going to happen to me if I am not able to continue my spiritual efforts, if I am not able to accommodate spiritual values into everyday family life. So then Krishna gives an answer. What he says is, well, you need not worry about that. See, spiritual life is something different from, spiritual wealth is different from material wealth. If you accumulate money in the bank, banks may collapse, the stock markets may collapse. So that could affect your fiscal position, you know. You may go bankrupt. But there is no bankruptcy in spiritual life. So it's a very interesting, very, very striking and very relevant message you get here. In spiritual life, even if you pray once, or maybe for some years, or if you read some scriptures, or if you associate with spiritual ideas, and then if you are not able to continue, whatever you have done, whatever efforts you have made in the right direction, will create a spiritual legacy which will not be destroyed at all. It can never be destroyed. So Vedanta says, this life is only just one of a series of cycles. Death is not the end of the journey. Death is only semicolon or a comma. When we are born again, we bring back with us a spiritual wealth which we inherit. Even if you try to discern it, you can't discern it, good and bad. So whatever we do, whatever actions we do, whatever experiences we undergo, will create an impression in the mental system. And that impression will get reinforced, strengthened, as we continue the same kind of action, or the same, if we speak the same type of words. And then it becomes a deep-rooted characteristic. And with this baggage, we are born again. We inherited these characteristics. So if you do some spiritual practice, we will accumulate a spiritual wealth which we inherit when we are born again. So we can never be born paupers. We'll be born with this result. So every action becomes an impression. An impression becomes a tendency. A tendency becomes a natural instinctive habit. And with that we are born. To give an example, it's a simple example. If you feel a natural tendency to spiritual values, and if you feel at home when we are discussing spiritual ideas, if you feel like enjoying higher ideas, it means we have accumulated certain tendencies in the past which have framed a mind, which have created a mindset which can feel at home in the company of spiritual ideas or spiritual persons. That's what Lord Krishna replies. Tatratam buddhisam yogam labhade parodekhikam yadadeja tato bhuyasam siddhu kurunantana. We are born again with that mental wealth in which spiritual tendencies, impressions are accumulated, and that will help us to continue our spiritual journey. This is the answer that Lord Krishna gives. Now, coming back to our subject, I'm just giving family. Now, what's the place of family in modern life? First of all, you know, family should be looked upon as a spiritual institution. That's the first principle. Family is not a secular institution. Family connections, family kinship, relationship, as a spiritual element in it. I can just quote one convocation address from one of the most ancient scriptures of humanity. It comes the Yajurveda Samhita. So in ancient times, you know, life in the Vedantic tradition was divided into four stages. When you are small, you go to school, and then after going through education, you become part of a social structure, you marry, become a responsible member of the family, responsible member of society, and then after reaching maybe advanced age, technically speaking, you know, it is said the old Sanskrit text tells you something very interesting. When you see the face of your grandson, that's the Sanskrit statement. Literal translation may be somewhat shocking. You know what it means? An householder, husband and wife, when they become old, when they see the face of the grandson or granddaughter, for that matter, which means the lineage should be secured, then they should not continue staying in their home or old age home watching the TV, watching the thrillers, or trying to, as in Indian family tradition, you know, the grandfather has to decide what course the grandson should join. So family life is over-organized in India, in Indian context, and it is absolute in a total chaos in Western context. And social life is so well-organized in Western world, and family life is maybe not so well-organized. So, there's an interesting thing. So, extreme organization of family structure in India stifles, strangulates the freedom, the self-reliance, the innovation, the sense of risk-taking ability. You know. So, that sort of thing happens. But if family structure becomes very loose and disorganized, a lot of freedom, innovation is there, but then something very very unpleasant happens in the overall social structure. So there were four stages in India. After going through 12 years of Vedic education, a youngster is leaving his school. At that time, a professor, the teacher, the sage, addresses a group of students and he gives them a set of instructions so that these students will become responsible husbands, wives, grandparents or fathers or parents or whatever may be. So this is kind of convocation address. I can quote this convocation address, which gives an insight into one sublime aspect of family in a civilization where family was looked upon as a spiritual institution, where the relationship between parents and children were given a kind of sacredness and sanctity. So you attach a degree of sanctity and sacredness to the connection, to the relationship between a son and his mother and a daughter and her mother and sister and so on. So when you look upon human relations with a sense of sanctity, then one advantage is there is no bitterness. See, if you go to a church or a temple or a synagogue, you pray, you don't get tired of praying. If you get tired of praying, then you should do some other work. If you can't pray in a temple or a church, then better clean up the woods, the weeds or the grass. That is also some kind of a service. So when our mind is ready, then we can pray, we can contemplate. So the relationship between different members of the family, and especially the relationship between parents and children, was looked upon as a sacred bondage. A sense of sanctity and sacredness was attached to this relationship. And when you attach sacredness and sanctity, then it becomes something very sweet, harmonious. You know, if you see how worshippers put flowers on the altar in this temple, they take the flower with a great sense of solemnity and put at the altar. You may go to a church, how the liturgy, or any religious institution where people do worship. So when you worship, you don't get tired. There is no bitterness. There is no boredom. So also, when and if you can attach a sense of sacredness and sanctity to family relations, then it becomes a wonderful thing. So that is what is happening here. Vedam anuchi acharya handayavasinam anushasti satyam vada dharmam chara satyana pramidavyam dharmana pramidavyam. These are the first paragraph. So I'm just quoting, reciting this. So I shall explain. So even if you don't bother about this recitation, you're not going to lose anything. What it means is, after teaching the Vedas for 12 years, a boy who is about 20 years is returning to his home to marry, to become a father or mother, whatever, maybe. Maybe the girls used to be given Vedic education in ancient times. So the first set of instructions, very universal instructions. You should speak the truth, you should not deviate from the path of truth. You should practice dharma, you should not deviate from the path of dharma. And then you should do the duties and responsibilities which are necessary for you to fulfill the needs of your family, your country, your nation. It's in ancient times, you know. And then come some instructions which are closely related to family connections. Matru Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava, Acharya Devo Bhava, Adithi Devo Bhava. The four instructions. So the first one is, literally it means you should revere, respect your mother as much as you revere or respect God himself. This is the first instruction. It doesn't mean that you should pray to your mother, no, that sort of thing. You should attach a sense of sanctity, a degree of sacredness to your relationship with your mother. Now, when you, as I mentioned earlier, when you attach a sense of sanctity, then what happens, you know, it becomes a very sublime, a very wonderful, a beautiful, an enriching, a spiritually enriching connection and fulfillment in family life. So, another verse in the Bhagavata Purana says, that mother is not an ideal mother who gives the child only food, shelter, but never teaches him or teaches her, depending upon the context, those values which will help the son or daughter to look upon her with a sense of sanctity. That's a literal meaning. That father is an ideal father who just gives wonderful education and money, but doesn't give the kind of education or instruction which will make the son an ideal member of the family. Literal transition. Now, if you give some kind of an interpretation to modern times, let us say, suppose you bring up the son, your children, forcing them, driving them, frequently driving them crazy so that they will go to MIT, nothing less than that. Just giving them only that, so that kind of instruction that may help them to get a higher job, make more money. Then what happens? Perhaps in many cases, they may get a high grade, they may get a wonderful job, they may make a lot of money, but then after having made all the money, after having got a wonderful job, they may not remember that they have an obligation, a sense of spiritual connection to his mother, without whose help he would not have made success in his life. So, along with other training, a mother should look upon her connection, her relationship with her son, not just a relationship that obliges her to give him money and education, but also spiritual instruction. If a mother doesn't give that kind of instruction to her son, then what happens? The son will dump her in an old age home to be looked after by paid staff. If the mother doesn't look after the child, doesn't give this kind of instruction, if the mother gives the responsibility of bringing up his or her son, the responsibility is given to paid staff, then when he grows up, he will give the responsibility of looking upon the mother to paid staff in old care home. So the child care homes and old care homes, they go in proportionately. There is a connection link between the two. So this particular text tells us that there is a sanctity and sacredness. And how do we express this sanctity? Parents should instruct their children not only in secular values but also in spiritual values. There are some wonderful parents who are highly inspiring, but the children should be taught to draw the right kind of inspiration and lesson from those examples. Otherwise, in modern complex social structure, where competition is a matter of survival, very often young generation may not have the sensitivity to appreciate higher values. Even if wonderful parents are there, children may not get the time or maybe the leisure to draw the right lessons from their parents. The second instruction is Pitru Devo Bhava. So these are two related. You should be able to look upon your father with the same sense of sanctity and sacredness with which you look upon God. Again, the implication is there is a spiritual connection to the relationship between children and their parents. That's a simple implication. A child first learns from mother. A child doesn't really get education. A child imbibes, not naturally, instinctively imbibes some of the great lessons by watching the mother. So also, in the family surroundings, the child also learns from the father. But along with other aspects, protection, wealth, help for getting a good job, with all these, we should be able to inculcate a sense of sanctity, a spiritual element in the institution of family, in family relationship. The third instruction, there are four instructions directly related to family life. The third instruction is the Acharya Devobhava, that is, Acharya, I mean teacher, just, you know, respecting the teacher. Now, I know very well that in our modern social structure, attributing or thinking of a sacred spiritual obligation, spiritual connection to teacher is very difficult even to conceive of intellectually. But then it has got a great value. Now, you know, we are trying in modern times, modern sociologists, anthropologists, even psychologists in some respects, they're trying to revive some of the ancient values which made human society slowly settle down and evolved this high civilization. So there is always a school of thinkers and sociologists who tell you that we can revive many of the ancient values. So what about the connection, the relationship between a teacher and a student? If a student could think of a spiritual connection to his teacher, if the relationship between a teacher and student could be looked upon with a sense of sanctity and sacredness, many of the problems of campus life and eventually many of the problems in family life and, of course, even workplace could be solved. An element of spiritual connection, a spiritual sacredness in the relationship, in the interaction between a student and a teacher. That's why in the Gita is a very wonderful text. If you read many modern books and if you read Gita, you find a lot of relevance. At the end of the text, there's a very interesting conclusion in the Gita. Lord Krishna makes two very important statements, apparently contradictory, but it's not contradictory, they're two aspects of the same coin. One teaching is, don't teach what I taught you to those who have no respect for the teacher, who have no respect to the subject that they are learning, and who don't have the wisdom or the intellectual maturity, the cultural maturity, to make proper use of the wisdom and knowledge that he receives at the hands of at the feet of the teacher. And those who are impolite, those who are not humble, don't teach this great spiritual wisdom to such people. This is how Lord Krishna concludes. So, you may think it's a kind of a highly conservative, orthodox, highly restrictive view. Not at all. What Lord Krishna says is this. In fact, in a broader way, this has a relevance even in modern education scenario. What Lord Krishna says is this. This great yoga, you know, karma yoga, bhakti yoga, meditation, prayer, higher spiritual values, could be taught only to those who have the wisdom and the maturity and the spiritual fitness. That means politeness and humility to understand. If you teach to somebody who may not be able to appreciate it, then the result could be the opposite. You can imagine, suppose you teach music to a person who is not at all interested in music. Suppose a father insists that his son should become a musician, and the son is interested in something else. The son will become an enemy of the father, and it's an enemy of the music, actually. So just give an example. So first of all, we must know that the student, the person who receives education, is interested. He has the wisdom, he deserves to learn that. And then he has the ability to absorb and digest it, make proper use of it, and you should avoid making improper use of it. And also those who do not respect the teacher, those who dishonor this tradition, the teacher, don't teach them. So this is a great instruction. In modern times, you may look upon this as something very very old, ultra-orthodox, highly restrictive thing. But the point is, there is a great wisdom in it. Along with education, we should also teach those values, spiritual values, which will help the student community, to observe and also to make proper use of what they learn in their schools or colleges. And for that, they should be able to look upon the teacher-student relationship as a kind of spiritual connection. Then you know what happens? The education becomes a sublime and enriching, a spiritually enriching process. Teaching profession used to be the noblest profession, because teacher never took salary and the students never paid fees. Of course, this is in ancient times, you know. You can't think of that in modern times. But still, the idea of a spiritual aspect to the whole process of education, not only spiritual education, even to secular education, it is something very sublime. If you think of great scientists, like a man like Newton. Newton is an example from modern scientific world. I would give an example of Dr. Radhakrishnan. Dr. Radhakrishnan was one of the greatest philosophers of 20th century. Who, after Vivekananda, he was the one who introduced Indian thought, rather Oriental thought, to the Western world at the academic level. Eastern religion, Western thought, a series of lectures which he delivered. He held the first chair in comparative philosophy in Oxford. So Dr. Radhakrishnan says in his autobiography, he could become what he became thanks to his teacher. Now, how do you explain this campus indiscipline, the problems, campus violence? And most of the problems related to educational world, campus indiscipline, violence, all that, can be reduced if you can bring up some of these values to modern times. If we can think of ecological values, if we can think of ecological hygiene, then what about these ancient spiritual values from ancient civilization? We can bring up them, and that would be a wonderful enriching factor for modern civilization. And of course, the fourth one is Atithi Devo Bhava. That means you should look upon your guest with the same respect with which you look upon God. Of course, I'm leaving that out for the time being, you know. That's something. So that will take us to different subjects. That's maybe not so very relevant to our context here. So the main focus is family should be looked upon as a spiritual institution, and the relationship between different members of the family should be looked upon as a spiritual relationship. And the reason why we bring in the spiritual element to family connections is this. You know, spirituality brings in the element of sacredness and sanctity. When something is sacred, when we attach sanctity to something, we don't ask questions. If somebody asks you, why should I put the flower at the altar of in a temple or a church? Why can't you throw it? Nobody asks such a question. Because it's taken for granted. Why can't it? If you throw it from a distance with indifference, then also the flower may reach the place. But we don't do that. There are certain things that we do without asking questions. We ask questions because we don't want to do that. So very often the tendency to ask questions is an expression of our unwillingness to accept it. So the first principle is the family should be looked upon as a spiritual institution, and relationship within family should be given a sense of sanctity and sacredness. Not only from a purely spiritual point of view, but even from the point of view of the survival of human civilization. Because even if technology solves most of our problems, it has already done to some extent. Even if we can attain a much higher level of prosperity, democracy, human rights, freedom, all these are wonderful. Open market economy, all these are wonderful things. But if all these things happen, still, if family life is disturbed, then civilization cannot survive. Maybe the one example that great modern historians like Toynbee brings out, the example of Roman Empire. It was the end of the last 200 years of Roman Empire that everything was falling into pieces. One grand example is taken from the examples of Roman Empire. So that's one aspect which we want to discuss. Another aspect is, apart from the sanctity or sacredness or the spiritual dimension of the institution of family, is the values that should guide family life, the fundamental values. Here again, we can take from Vedanta four fundamental values. These are universal values. Not Vedanta means it's come from ancient Vedic tradition, that's all. But it's very universal. So the four values that used to guide family life in ancient times, in Sanskrit it's called dharma, artha, kama and moksha. So I said, in English what do you say? Dharma is the first one, moksha is the last one. Dharma actually means some kind of a regulatory principle, fundamental ethical code. Every modern state, nation state, every nation as a constitution that is built upon the principle of dharma, do's and don'ts, rules and regulations, which are necessary for the survival, for society and the nation. So it expresses in the form of a constitution, with a federal law, the state law. It also expresses in the form of conventions, which automatically all of us follow in a society, in a social structure. Certain conventions, certain given practices, which we normally don't question, which are obviously important for the very survival of human civilization. It's called dharma. So that's why dharma, the word dharma has got very interesting Sanskrit. Dhru is the dhatu. Dhru dharididhi dharma, which means something which upholds, preserves, something which helps it survive. That's the meaning of word dharma. That which helps you to survive, that which preserves certain eternal values. That's a regulatory principle. The two other principles are principles that we normally follow in our secular life. Money, wealth, status, hard work, education. These are the means we need. People need in modern times to get a job, to do business. We need education. We need wealth. And then desires. Kama means certain aims and goals, ideals that we are trying to achieve or fulfill. So these are three values, the first set of values, which constitute the very cornerstone of modern civilized democratic societies. Constitutions, laws, judiciary, law enforcement system, an executive, legislative structure, all these together constitute different aspects of dharma in actual practice, in social context, in individual context, and also national context. Then means, wealth, education, and also our natural ambitions. All these are already taken for granted in any modern civilized society. A law enforcement system, a judiciary system, an executive, or a legislature, and certain and educational institutions, wealth-producing industries and business houses, all these are taken for granted. These are integral parts of modern, civilized, democratic life structure. But there is one aspect which is wanting here. Now, if you read the translation of the word moksha, you get the English word liberation. That may not have any, apparently, that may not have any connection to the age in which we are living. The liberation here means the fulfillment. I mentioned earlier the examples of highly advanced welfare states. Japan, highest degree of depression. Holland, Switzerland, suicides. So these are all, these nations are examples of democratic social structures which have fulfilled all the three basic values. I mean, a regulatory principle, education, wealth, everything. But then there is something wanting there. That's why when we evolve to a particular, to a very high level of economic prosperity, we reach a point where we feel there is a problem, but the problem is vague. There's a lot of ambiguity. But people feel something wanting. And that higher value is the high spiritual fulfillment, which is implied by the word liberation, or moksha. We'll discuss that value in the next session. So now we'll have interaction for 30 minutes, you are most welcome to give your suggestions. And it not be some kind of a teaching. You can give your ideas. We can share a discussion. We can open.
Namaskar, Swami. Yeah. So, touching upon the four values of that we just last discussed, is there any nature of conflict in each of the values that are being mentioned here?
Yeah. There's a conflict if you don't keep in mind the fourth value. So, wealth, ambitions, artha and kama do not constitute an end in itself. So, if we look upon artha and kama, we call material prosperity, achievement, secular advancement, as an end in itself, then there will be a problem. So there will be a big problem if you look upon these two values, that means the means for success, wealth or secular prosperity as an end in itself. The fourth value, which we are going to discuss, tells us that we should not look upon them as ultimate values. If you look upon them as ultimate values, there will be a conflict. But if you look upon them as values that we have to transcend before reaching a higher value, then there will be no conflict.
Namaste Guruji. I had a question with regards to the family structure you were discussing about how relationships in a family should be treated with the same kind of or analogous sanctity like you would with your relationship with God. So the first challenge to that, and the biggest one is, I think we are able to relate like that to God because
I shall correct, just 1 minute. I was literally translating that statement. It should be taken only as a metaphor.
Okay.
The idea is human relations should be looked upon with a sense of sanctity.
True.
So Vedic language, these Vedic Sanskrit statements, they use metaphors.
Right.
So it should be taken only in that. That not literally, should not be taken literally.
True.
What it implies, as I repeat it again and again, is that we should attach a sense of sanctity to these family links, connection. That's what it implies.
True.
Yeah.
But I was thinking that the biggest challenge is that we are all humans, and in family, being humans, we are extremely flawed, which becomes the biggest challenge to most relationships, even within a family. So what is your advice in dealing with severely flawed human beings who are fulfilling these roles of both parents and daughters and sons and son-in-laws and daughter-in-laws? Do you have any advice in that regard?
What one could do is to, when we try to bring up the next generation, the growing generation, we can keep this idea in mind. We cannot go back, and it doesn't, very often all people may not be familiar with these ideas, but one way to look upon them is that there is a spiritual bond in family connections. It's true that there are situations where you cannot see much spirituality or sacredness there. That's true. But then when we look upon this connection from our perspective, we should be able to remember. That will reduce the friction to a substantial extent. That's all.
Thank you, Swami. Blessings, and thank everyone. I'm going to be soft-spoken as I can. I recently had a question that came up around success. Actually, it's been there for years. And this world in the 21st century is now having like you said, the demand. Being successful is, you know, being wealthy, and I do believe in prosperity from both being able to make ends meet and not seeing that that's the end of the day or making bread last. And yet I also see the other success of happiness and prosperity and not necessarily going to Broadway to me in the 21st century still is the only success, but it is for many. So there's a disconnect between success, spiritual success, and saying, I'm okay that I didn't go to Broadway and that I wasn't produced by so-and-so, but it's not okay with the rest of the world. So there's something really off about that disconnect. And the other point I want to make is Pablo Coelho, whom I respect and whom is still living, I did receive a message from him, and it was something about a question of success and your soul. And I thought it was profound. And I was like, Success to me is many things. And it is also being able to know that when I wake up the next morning, that I woke up the next morning and I was alive. And although that doesn't answer it, it for me is that I'm happy that I get up in the morning. I may not have $1 million, but I may have it without knowing it. So, but yet the demands of success in the business world is a challenge for me because you have to be online and you have to hustle and you have to, and it's not working. And I'm trying to look at a balance between the two because I have the spiritual piece and still practicing that, but then it's not jiving with LinkedIn and whatever else. The two are not, because I'll say something and it'd be like, no. Your legacy. I'm like, well, my legacy, my mother gave me a legacy. She's an ancestor, and I'm honoring her legacy. But that's not successful to other successors. So it may be a complicated way of asking that question because I don't know if there is an answer, but it's not resonating with the other world, the modern world, the 21st century world, with technology being the almost God, if you will. And that is not to disrespect the wealth and prosperity that technology brings, but it's to look at how do we make the two, the gap, the disconnect, because something's not working. Yeah. Either I'm not articulating the reality of it, or is it me? Because I'm starting to like question, like, oh, you know, maybe I should go back to school and get a PhD. I'm happy that I have a master's. I mean, my school is gone. Yeah, I mean, now I have to prove that my school existed. It's gone. It doesn't exist anymore.
True.
So anyway.
So wonderful. You should go for success, but you should not worship success. You should not become a devotee of success. Success, the material world. You can't run away from it. But don't worship success. Don't become a devotee of success. Don't become a devotee of that God which identifies itself with success. It doesn't make a problem. Because that success may turn out to be a failure, maybe within a few hours or a few years. So it's not everlasting success. So there is another kind of success which is everlasting. That is contentment. So there is one verse which says that contentment is the highest wealth. If you are contented, you are wealthy. If you are not contented, you are poor, though you may own the whole world. So that's the Sanskrit verse says. So contentment. See, contentment should be need some interpretation. Contentment in a very profound sense. Is not only just satisfaction, as you understand the superficial meaning. You get the feeling, well, you have got something beyond which you do not have to look for anything else. So, it's just like a coin with only one side. Normally, satisfaction, as we understand at the secular level, just one side of the coin, it becomes dissatisfaction after some time. It goes on changing. But contentment, in the deeper sense, is everlasting. It doesn't come just because you gain something at the secular level. It is kind of inner feeling, which gives you a feeling of inner fulfillment, inner perfection, inner completeness. And then when you have it, you don't look for anything else. It stays there. So that comes when you connect with the spiritual success, going beyond the material success. That's what it is.
Yeah. Namaste, Swami. Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Namo Ramakrishnaya. Namo Saradambaya. Namo Vekanandaya. In this, I've been overwhelmed with your masterly expo. Talk of fundamental Sanatana values. May I say one thing? When Acharya Devo Bhava, fair enough. Now, in this modern world, our Acharya, right from the morning, is either Bill Gates or Microsoft, nothing else. But I want to stress, when we are talking about spiritual values, it's not spiritual values in the sense of Vasudeva or Vyasa, like God, Mother and all that. The fundamental factor of universe is Pancha Bhutal.
We are going to discuss it in the coming session.
So a child or adult or a family, to get up in the morning, first of all, you touch your Bhumi, Dharti, and salute the Bhumi that it is giving us food, it is looking after us, it is bearing our all our sins. And secondly, you look at the sun, and that is, pray God, you are giving us all the energy for the rest of the day. And thirdly, you breathe fresh air, and that oxygen is making you to live good life. And then you salute the water. Without a pure water or even a water, there is no life. Yeah. We are really making the water very impure by our habits. Yeah. We must see that water is conserved, water is preyed upon, and looked after it so well. So Panchendrayam is fundamental for every individual. At the moment, the society is not giving any values to these five. I would stress that in this August conference as a very important factor.
Certainly. Sir.
Thank you very much.
So that's very wonderful. That's very important, yeah. Pure, yeah. That's right. Yeah, please.
Swamiji, you talked about the four stages of life, and you said the third stage is, today you said when you begin to see the face of your grandchildren, in the past you have said, when your hair turns gray, that's the time to think about it. And you've given examples of Vyasa and others in the past where they were great householders who then went on to live a life in solitude, right, in that third stage. How do you map that in the modern era? What does that third stage look like for people in the modern age?
Well, you know, in modern times, when you reach a particular stage of economic prosperity, maturity, it's time to retire, then spending time working for a noble cause, or if you cannot go to a lonely place and contemplate or spend your time on higher contemplation or scripture studies, working for a noble cause itself is a kind of the third stage. It's something like the third stage, where you retire yourself from your own natural obligations, professional obligations, which are with the motive to make money, to make wealth, to cover the family, all this. Beyond that, when you have already fulfilled all these early needs, then you should think of doing something for the welfare of others, welfare of other humanity, without any selfish motive. You find people doing that these days, indirectly. So the literal meaning of the verse which I quoted is that you should go to a forest. The word used in Vijayana means a place with solitude. Solitude could be interpreted differently, you know. When you stop working for making more and more money, putting more money in the bank, when you already have plenty of it, then, and when you start working for the good of some noble causes, good of others for noble causes, that itself becomes a spiritually uplifting diversion at that stage. And that gives us that feeling. When you do something good for others, there is a psychological benefit. Even there are some books which mention, even medical doctors say, is your system, nervous system, breathing system, metabolic, all these things get benefited when you start thinking and trying to do good for others without any BP, any anxiety, good for noble cause. So that's a higher way of life, spiritual life. After fulfilling all duties, responsibilities, the children, parents, members of the family, and others. That's what it means. Yeah.
My question is, as a teacher, in terms of trying to bring people's minds more to these higher spiritual values in a secular university, for example, what are some advice? Because, for example, you know, in our spiritual practice, sharing or talking too much about it, I think sometimes inside you feel more degraded, actually. Yeah. So what's the right balance, or some advice about doing that kind of work?
Yeah. Well, if the word spirituality itself implies something not so very desirable in many circles, then you need not mention that. We can talk about, well, along with working hard, trying to get a high grade, a good job, you should also think of some higher values in life. So without mentioning in so many words, spirituality or religion, higher things, you can bring your students to realize it, its importance. That's possible. So when you get a good job, when you succeed in all your set goals, still there is something beyond that. So if you bring the new generation student community to this higher understanding without mentioning the word religion or spirituality, they won't mind. When you mention the word, immediately all the unpleasant associations will come crowding together in your mind. Very unfortunate, but that can be avoided. You can mention all the related values and ideas without mentioning that particular word as such. That's possible. Yeah.
Thank you. The spiritual value of helping others in the world, in one's family, and then there is the possibility of one going too far and, in fact, sort of losing oneself or losing one's life direction by too much. What are the limiting or guiding principles that can help avoid that while still being true to a spiritual path?
Well, in a spiritual values will integrate and harmonize all other achievements in our life. So, if we can bring in spiritual values into secular obligations, into secular realities, then you will find another significance, another relevance to the life as a whole. Is life just working hard to make money, to succeed in secular life, or is life something beyond that? So that what lies beyond it? Really, there is no answer in so many words. The real answer comes when we realize the limitation of success at the empirical level. And then what is the real success? The real success, real contentment, inner harmony and peace. This can be done, as I mentioned, you know, by working for the good of others after having completed one's own individual obligations to family members, to society as a whole. When we reach the retiring age, if we can extend our service, our efforts beyond the circles of our own family relations, then actually something else begins to happen in our mind. It cannot be explained. There's a special joy, a kind of contentment that naturally comes when we become little more, when we become more and more unselfish. when we extend our service, our efforts, our life beyond our own immediate circles, there is an inner joy and harmony that we experience. It cannot be explained, really. The one mystery is, why many of these rich, super rich, multimillionaires, multi-billionaires, captains of industry, when they reach one level of prosperity, they feel a psychological need to start a trust. They may not be believing God. They may not be reading the Bible or Bhagavad Gita or anything. But there are many of them are just humanists, noble people, noble-hearted, well-meaning people. And they start foundations and trust to help people suffering from earthquakes, Ebola. You find many of these billionaires start foundations, invest money. The real, it's not that they want to do that. There is a psychological compulsion. And this doesn't happen to everyone. This happens only to some noble people who are a little more highly evolved. Others will accumulate more. They make, after millions, they become billions, then trillions. And goes on. And finally, but then they won't be able to get 4 hours sleep. But there are people who evolve still further. No, let us do something good for others. And there are billionaire captains of industry who don't put all the money, give all the money to their own relations. They start trust for doing others. I will tell you something, and its connection to these four values I mentioned. Dharma, Artha, Kama and Moksha. Dharma means the regulatory principle, the ethical principles, the principles of righteousness and ethical values. The other two values are the means and the goals. Okay. Now, if a person has not deviated from the path of Dharma, this ethical principle, in his pursuit of wealth, if he has never deviated from the path of this ethical principle while pursuing the path of secular prosperity, then naturally there is a particular stage that he reaches, because he's a noble person, he has made money through proper means, then he starts thinking, well, what lies beyond? The idea of liberation, this may not come to many people. But they start thinking of something beyond their money or beyond accumulating more and more money. Then suddenly they start a family trust, fighting Ebola victims. I've seen sub-Saharan countries of earthquake victims of Philippines and things like that. It's a natural evolution. God has no role in this. Religion has no role in this. It's a natural spiritual evolution of noble-hearted people. And Vedantic scriptures mention this very clearly. It's a natural evolution. Now, the opposite picture is also given. Suppose a person has made this huge wealth through improper means. Then he doesn't do that. Then he goes down and hit the rock bottom after reaching the highest peak of material prosperity. Instead of starting a trust, what he does, he hits the rock bottom. He goes the opposite way. So those who deviate from the path of Dharma, they don't go through this natural evolution towards a higher ideal. So it's a natural evolution. And this is sometimes stated in the yoga psychology, it is stated as a natural emotion of every noble-hearted person who has succeeded and attained success through proper means will start thinking of something beyond this success. And that is why Buddha was born a prince. He was the son of a king. He had all wonderful things. And when he saw that face of a dead body, when he saw the face of a an old man and a sick man. Suddenly, he had not even heard of such things as sickness, death or old age. He was brought up in such a cloistered family structure. He was not allowed to come out. That was the, there is a historical background behind it, which I don't want to go into right now. When he was born, his astrologers, the king's astrologers, predicted that this man may become an emperor, a great emperor, or a great emperor of ascetics. So the father wanted, his father, the king, Suddhodana's name, he wanted he should become a king, not a king of ascetics. So he was forced to grow up in a cloistered palace. No freedom to come out. So when he was 28 years old, he was already married, he had a son. One day he was being taken out in a chariot by his charioteer. And as he was taken around the streets, he met an old man, a sick man, and a procession. A dead body was being taken to the cremation ground. So these three tragic realities suddenly opened his eyes. So there is such a thing as death and old age and sickness. He was shocked. That night he left his palace, walked 200 miles, went to what is now known as Buddh Gaya, where he attained illumination, and he sat under a tree with a strong determination. And you know, he took a vow. The vow is expressed in the famous Sanskrit biography of Buddha, Lalita Vistara. Ihasane Sushudu Me Shariram Tugasti Mamsam Chavilayam Chayatuhu Aprapi Siddhim Bhu Janma Durlabham Naivasanat Kaya Madas Chalishire. Sanskrit verse. What it means is, I am sitting here under this tree with a strong determination. Let my body be reduced to bones, marrow, and bone, let it perish. I won't get up from the seat before I realize the highest spiritual enlightenment. So that's the vow he took. And he sat under the tree. That's how the story goes. It comes in the Sanskrit biography belonging to 2nd century AD. So the whole story is, when he saw the dead body, the old man's face, and this sick man's face, these miserable pictures, it was not his problem. It was not his problem. He was not old. He was not sick. It was problems of other people. So he wanted to know the mystery behind these problems of humanity. So that made him think. So when we can think of other people's problems, it is a kind of spiritual evolution. When we have solved our problems, and when we think, when we can think of other people's problems and look upon them as our problems, that's a great spiritual evolution. So here, there is no God coming into play. And there is no role for any organized religion. A human being can evolve if he follows or she follows some ethical principles and succeeds in secular life. Then naturally, of course, Vedanta will tell you, if not in this life, in next life, he will continue his evolution to a higher ideal. This is the whole picture. So we'll continue the discussion in the afternoon. We will have discussion from 3 to 4:30 p.m. And today and tomorrow, 2nd and 3rd September, 10 to 11:30 a.m. the morning discussion. From 11:30 to 12 noon, break, and will be given snacks. No snacks? Okay. No, okay, best. Okay, I withdraw the promise, okay. Okay, I thought, okay, it doesn't matter. Anyway, 1:15 to 2:15 p.m. lunch, that, please remember, 1:15 p.m. to 2:15 p.m. lunch, then 3 to 4:30 p.m. discussion, and Monday, September 4th, 10 to 11:30 a.m. discussion, then refreshments from 11:30 to 12 noon, and then 12 to 12:30 p.m. meditation on Monday. So thank you. So we'll assemble here for meditation from 12 to 1 p.m. Of course, meditation will be there in this in our main lecture hall, meditation shrine, just adjacent. And here we assemble again at 3 o'clock for discussion. Thank you. Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.